For the past 3 years, the Science of Reading Star Awards have honored educators who are beacons of light, guiding their classrooms, schools, districts, and most importantly, students through transformations with literacy. Now join us as we honor this year's winners at a special celebration event, which will feature celebrity keynoters and past podcast guests. Mitchell Brookins.
2 years ago, one of my students as a school administrator came to me on the playground and he said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to be like the other kids." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to learn how to read."
And Malcolm Mitchell.
When I scored a touchdown, they either probably put my name in a newspaper. People probably tell me good job all around town. But when I finished one book, no one ever said anything. So which one am I more likely to repeat?
Find out more information and register for the 2024 Science of Reading Star Awards Ceremony at amplify.com/Star Awards Celebrations. That's amplify.com/Star Awards Celebration, all one word.
How do we help students become confident readers? And what do all our students need so they can enjoy reading success, especially during this unprecedented time? Welcome to Season 3 of Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. This season, we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of Scarborough's Reading Rope, a model that helps us understand the complexities of learning to read and helps us focus on evidence-based practices. Each episode will cover elements of the model, what it means, and how it should impact classroom instruction. We've lined up a dream team of Science of Reading experts we think you'll really love. The Science of Reading movement continues to grow, and at a time that is more important than ever. It's vital we focus on research-based practices to deliver classroom instruction that allows students to learn. If they aren't learning, we need to examine our practices. We may not know what changes are coming next, but we do know we need to stay connected, and learning from each other will get us through it. The more we learn and listen, the more we'll be prepared to lead. Our students are counting on us. What a roller coaster ride the first half of 2021 has been. And here at Science of Reading, the podcast, as we prep for back to school, we're feeling energized by all of the knowledge we've acquired these past 6 months. If you've been with us all along, we made it. If you just joined us, we're so glad to have you. We've spent this season deconstructing Scarborough's Reading Rope, what each element means, how they interact, and how they come together to create successful readers. I can't resist sharing a few favorite quotes that bring the rope to life. Dr. Jane Oakhill, professor of experimental psychology at the University of Sussex, walked us through why the simple view of reading continues to be relevant and proven by an increasing body of research, almost 40 years after its creation.
So, the points, Gough and Toonmer's Simple View, I think their first paper was published in 1986, and their idea was that variation in reading, by which they mean reading comprehension, so understanding text, can be captured simply in two main components, which they termed decoding, and linguistic comprehension, which others have labelled language understanding. Now, it's important to understand that the name simple view is not meant to imply that reading or learning to read is a simple process. What they were trying to capture is that this is a simple way to conceptualise the complexity of reading. And one thing that was new about their conceptualization was that they argued that these two components, the decoding and linguistic comprehension, depend on really quite different skills and processes. So another thing that Simple View emphasizes, and the rope model, is that the importance of teaching these strands, regarding these strands as both important, and teaching those from the outset of teaching reading. The idea is that reading comprehension, is the product, not the sum of those two components. So that if one of them is zero, then overall reading ability is going to be zero, because anything multiplied by zero is zero, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, things are not usually that extreme, right? So it's not typical to find, it's typical to find children who at the outset a child would have zero word decoding a skill but some language reading ability. But once children start learning to read, they tend to have some ability in each of the strands, but that might be quite unbalanced. There's one nice example of how these strands can be completely differentiated, though, and that comes from a story about John Milton and his strategy for reading text in Greek after he became blind. And what he did was he got his daughters to learn to decode the ancient Greek alphabet. Though they didn't understand a word of spoken Greek, they dutifully learnt to decode Greek so they could read the Greek texts aloud and Milton could understand them, even though he couldn't read the words. So it's as though they were each different strands in the simple view. So Milton's daughters provided the decoding skills and Milton provided the language comprehension skills. And together he got to reading comprehension.
Yeah. With that context, Dr. Oakhill talked us through Scarborough's rope and how the elements intertwine to develop skilled readers.
Apparently Scarborough's rope model was conceived entirely independently of the simple view. I didn't realise that until very recently. It had been in her mind for many years prior to the initial publication of it in 2001. And she initially conceptualised it as a graphic for a talk handout, as a sort of visual metaphor. And she wanted it to simply conceptualise in a simple and straightforward way the findings that fed into the two different strands of reading. So you could almost regard it like a sort of framework for a literature review. What's important to reading in these two different from these two different aspects. So unlike the simple view, which is really is a testable theory, the rote model is more of a framework for understanding reading. And another difference is that Scarborough's rote model provides much more detail of the processes and skills that contribute to the two strands. The basis of the two strands is pretty much the same, the word reading and the language comprehension strands. But the rote model emphasises the more of the details of the processes that contribute to effective reading. So again, it's emphasising that reading is in fact quite complicated, and it also represents the idea that these strands are mutually interdependent. So the language comprehension strands and the word reading strands are intertwined within those two strands to start with, and then gradually through development, and that's an aspect of Scarborough's rote model that isn't in the simple view, it's a developmental model. So across time, everything becomes more and more integrated, more automatic, so that reading in time kind of flows together into this integrated whole that just happens when we read for comprehension.
Well, that really sums it up, doesn't it? Everything science tells us about how successful readers develop in just 3 minutes. Well, maybe not everything. But if I had a colleague asking to know what the science of reading means, I'd start them right there. So as we've just heard, the first half of Scarborough's rope is all about language comprehension. And of course, language comprehension starts with background knowledge, right? If you don't know anything about baseball, the best play-by-play commentary in the world is going to be pretty tough to parse.
Susan Newman, professor of childhood and literacy education at the Steinhardt School at New York University, came to us to explain the link between background knowledge and reading comprehension in the science of reading. She shared her 5 research-based principles for building knowledge networks during your instruction.
A great deal of my training and of what people were saying is that children really need to activate their background knowledge. That when you read, the first process that a teacher would do is to give them a sense of purpose and say, activate your background knowledge. But then I realized a very valuable lesson. What if they didn't have it? Mm-hmm. What if they didn't have the background knowledge in order to activate? You could say to them, activate your background knowledge till kingdom come. But if they don't have it, they can't activate it. And so it became a real challenge for me to try and understand, well, what do you do when there isn't any? And that's why content knowledge became so critically important to me. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting because I do remember, this was a long time ago. I'm surprised I still remember, but I do remember in my undergraduate program learning about like activating prior knowledge I'm not sure they call it background knowledge at that point. So what do you do? Well, first of all, that impacts reading comprehension. We all know that. What about comprehension? What is the connection there between background knowledge and comprehension?
Well, in my view, let me first say that I do not see comprehension as a generic skill. Mm. Some people think so, but I don't. So, for example, if I would read a 6th grade text in science, which is not my forte, I would probably have a little bit of a problem in trying to understand some of the concepts and some of the terms. I would probably not be able to connect and to activate any background knowledge. And so what I began to realize is that side of Scarborough's mm-hmm. language comprehension, to a great extent, it's two critical things. It's vocabulary and it's knowledge. It's content knowledge. And if you don't have content knowledge, you're likely not to be able to comprehend text. Now, this has an enormous implication, because what it means is that we have been spending our time on comprehension strategies instead of teaching content knowledge.
Nancy Hennessy, past president of the International Dyslexia Association, built on this by defining the role of vocabulary and how to explicitly teach vocabulary through her research-backed 4-pronged approach.
Yeah, well, I did think a lot about this, because I think oftentimes when we now, or even in the past, have thought about vocabulary, we immediately connect it to a definition. And yes. And so it's so much more than that. It really is, as I describe in the book, it's our lexicon. It's our knowledge of word meaning, whether we know words what I would consider a surface way or a deep way, but it's our knowledge of word meaning that we can use for varied purposes. So I talk about our lexicon, our mental dictionary, as being used for both receptive and expressive purposes. I think that's really critical for us to be thinking about. Receptive in terms of listening and reading, and then expressive certainly in terms of speaking and writing. You know, how we go about defining vocabulary then is going to really direct and inform, not so much direct, but inform the way we think about our instruction. So the other aspect of defining or describing vocabulary that I think is important is that we recognize that there's a difference between breadth and depth, right? And I can remember reading an article by, I believe it was Rick Wagner, Tannenbaum Wagner, and another colleague a number of years ago, in which they addressed breadth versus depth. And I had never thought about vocabulary in this way. So breadth having to do with all the words that we more or less recognize, the size of our vocabulary, all right? And more often than not, when we think about breadth, We think about recognizing those words because they're within a context that helps to support the recognition, right? Depth has everything to do with how many words we actually own, or our richness of knowledge, those words that we can use not only receptively, but also expressively. And, you know, the more interaction we have with word, the deeper our knowledge base. So, you know, when we think about this ability to express understanding, to use precise language, and I love that in the reading rope, Scarborough, you know, talks a bit, or in the descriptor of the strand for vocabulary, she indicates, you know, the importance of breadth and depth and precision. In order to use words precisely, we really have to have a depth of knowledge. And then the other aspect that when I talked about what vocabulary is thinking about, well, how do you acquire vocabulary? How does this happen for us? And again, this has implication for instructional design. And we know that we acquire the meaning of words over time, bit by bit. It's incremental. And so I think I talked a little bit about young children. Think about those little ones that we know who seem to pick up on every word that they hear. We call that fast mapping. But unless they continue to have experiences with those words so that they can slow map them into their lexicon, they kind of go away. But anyway, it's bit by bit. And so continued exposure and use to word. The other thing, recognizing a definition alone is not sufficient because words are interrelated. And this has everything to do with background knowledge, doesn't it? So, yeah. So we're storing words in networks of meaning. And so, you know, when we hear a word now, like comprehension, what comes to mind? what's within that network? What's related to that particular meaning?
Our focus on language comprehension continued with Kate Kane talking us through the role of language structure in the simple view of reading and why reading aloud to children from a very young age is so important for many, many reasons.
So if we think about the rote model, the language structures referred to there, we think of semantics and we think of syntax. So we'll start with semantics and think about its relation to both vocabulary and comprehension, I think, would be useful, and then move on to thinking about syntax. And I think it's important to note to listeners that researchers are not always precise. We can be a little bit sloppy in the language we use, and I think there can be a lot of confusion because sometimes vocabulary and semantics are used somewhat interchangeably. But what we're really talking about with vocabulary, we're referring to the words a child has got in their lexicon. What words do they know? With semantic skills, we're referring to the ability to understand these words and use them appropriately. Mm. You know, and a good example that's often used, like there's a world of difference between saying, I robbed a bank and a bank robbed me. You know, yeah. So it's actually sort of like that appropriate use. But when we're thinking about the study of semantics, we're often also talking about semantic relations. So we have some words are associated because they often occur together in texts, because they actually kind of like occur together in place. So collocations, thinking of like sandcastle and beach. And we have other words that might be associated because they share features. So you can think of different shades of meaning, if you like. So cry, sob, wail, all to do with sort of like expressing that emotion. And then other words can have related but also distinct meanings. So think of wave. You can wave hello. You can have a wave in the ocean. You can have a sound wave. And I think it can get a little bit confusing when we're thinking about the relation with comprehension, because we often talk about vocabulary breadth, how many words does a child know the meaning of, and also vocabulary depth, what does a child know about these words. And often then we're really talking about semantics. Ugh. And this idea that sort of one of the things I think is important to get across is that comprehension of text is really enriched by access to having a lexicon of word meanings that we can use precisely, but also flexibly. We have a lot of words in our language that have multiple meanings. It's also enriched by having these rich semantic networks where we have links between these related words, as I was sort of explaining before. And if you think about it specifically in relation to comprehension and why this is so important, I mean, some of the work that I've conducted with Jane, actually, we've looked at this relation between vocabulary breadth and depth to inference making. With vocabulary depth, we're thinking about these rich semantic networks and these associations, so children are actually able to use these words appropriately. And we looked at that in relation to another important comprehension skill, which is inference making. And we actually found that vocabulary depth, so children's knowledge about multiple meanings of words and the relations between different words and, you know, the precise context in which they should be used, was a stronger predictor of some aspects of inference making than simply vocabulary breadth, word knowledge alone. So children who have these sort of like richer semantic networks are more likely to make critical inferences that are filling in sort of missing detail. I mean, you said earlier about, you know, like an author doesn't necessarily include all the details in a text. So the way we've looked at this experimentally is we've deliberately written text that keeps some details missing.
And finally, Sonia Cabell, assistant professor at the School of Teacher Education at Florida State University, walked through what language comprehension really means in the simple view of reading and how parents and educators can help children develop literacy skills through advanced language models.
When I think about language comprehension, you know, we think about it in terms of the simple view or Scarborough's rope, and we think about the ability to understand what is being said or read aloud. And more technically, a technical definition might be the ability to derive meaning from spoken words when they're part of sentences or other discourse. I got that from Reading Rockets website. But basically, when I think about language comprehension, I think about the contributors to language comprehension. And I think about the language skills that children need to have, and that includes things like vocabulary and syntactical knowledge, the academic language that's needed. I also think about the knowledge that children need to really understand what they're listening to or reading.
And I think it's a little misunderstood, particularly when we're talking about it in relationship to reading proficiency, that when we talk about language comprehension, we're really talking about that ability to work in the oral environment first.
Right, exactly. You know, it's so if you think about the simple view being, you know, reading comprehension is a product of decoding and language comprehension, that language comprehension sits in that oral language type of space.
Wow, that's the first major strand of Scarborough's rope all wrapped up. And now that we've thought it through language comprehension, the second half of Scarborough's rope is focused on word recognition, beginning with phonological awareness. Dr. Louisa Motes talked to us about the value of becoming students of our own language. She also brought to life the beginning reader's struggle to connect phonemes with letters and the impact making that connection can have on the life of a child.
It's important to teach it explicitly because a lot of kids can't figure it out on their own. A minority of kids do figure it out on their own. But the vast, the middle third will do it much better and more quickly if it's explained to them. The bottom third really needs to have it explained because they do not teach themselves very readily at all. And unless we teach them explicitly how it's working, they are stymied. I mean, I've had adults tell me that they had to flunk out of school in eighth grade, who said to me, I could never figure out what them alphabets was for. And, you know, statements like that are just heartrending because they're so emblematic of what we know from research, that staring at these alphabetic symbols does not guarantee that they're going to register in the person's brain as a representation of sounds, either phonemes or syllables, or meaningful parts of words, morphemes, or the grammatical units that are represented in print. So all of that needs to be explained, and it needs to be taught also, especially in the case of English, because English is a more complex representational system than some of the others on the earth. It takes longer to learn because of it, the complexity of the relationship between speech and print and the multi-layered representation of language. So some languages, for example, are very transparent alphabetic languages where if you learn a sound for each symbol, you can pretty much decode the words. In English, that's not the case. It's not that direct. It's so, you know, stop me if I'm getting too detailed. So,
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, let me just stay on this topic of why we need to teach it.
Yeah.
And then the heart of reading fluency is automatic word recognition. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, reading and the insidious part of this is that it's so hidden from view. What the brain has to do is so hidden from view in the proficient reader. So you and I read automatically. We look at words. Our brain processes them in milliseconds. Our eyes scan the text. We register almost every letter that we look at. Our eye looks ahead to process the phrases. We put it all together really fast. But how do we do that? We do that because the individual words are automatized. We have what's called a sight vocabulary. And I'm using that term differently from the way it's often used in reading instruction to refer to irregular words. But the sight vocabulary is the is that all those words we recognize without hesitation, without conscious effort, when we've become proficient. So you can't learn to read without that. And fluency is driven by these bottom-up processes of first recognizing the letters, then the graphemes, which are the representational units for the phonemes in spoken word. And then in addition, we have in English conventions for representing syllable patterns and syllable units. And then we have spellings for common morphemes or meaningful parts that are quite standard and predictable in spite of the fact that the pronunciation of those spelling units shifts when we have complex words with prefixes and roots and suffixes.
Talk about powerful. Sometimes I think we need to pause more often and think about the effect our daily work is having to transform lives. The science of reading tells us with the right research-based practices, 95% of all children can be taught to read on or close to grade level. 95%! And it all begins with good instruction. Alice Wingetz from Unbound Ed joined us to unpack word recognition and its foundations and how strands twisted together become stronger and stronger.
Word recognition is the ability to recognize words and to some extent spelling patterns, right? So that when we are reading, we can immediately recognize a word and not have to expend cognitive capacity trying to figure out what the word is. And that word recognition develops over time through lots of experiences and exposures, but is built on a foundation of understanding the sound system of our language.
And so it's not memorizing words on flashcards to get that word recognition. It actually starts at a different level.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I think it initially starts with the phonology part, right? The sound, the pronunciation of words. That is sort of the foundation for phonics instruction, and it develops a little bit faster than the ability to actually just recognize a word and connect that word to meaning. And so it's a great starting point to sort of get things started. And I want to go back to the rope for a second. The strands in the rope, which I know you've discussed before, I think about that analogy, and I also think about what that visual, it's such a beautiful visual for talking about this stuff, but what that visual doesn't show you that I just want to remind listeners is that each of those strands is reciprocal with reading in one way or another. And I'll go in a little bit more detail in just a minute. But I want to kind of finish the other part of the analogy is that each of those strands is obviously stronger together than it is on its own. And when those strands are sort of interwoven or braided as they appear or twisted as they appear in the rope, they're even more strong. And what I mean by that is that when a student develops that phonological awareness and begins to be able to apply the alphabetic principle to decode words, then they can begin reading. And when they read, it strengthens their decoding. And the more they decode, the more they can read. And the more they read, the more they begin to recognize spelling patterns and the beginning of word recognitions. They might begin to recognize shorter words. And the more words they recognize, the better they read and the more they can read. And like all of these strands are reciprocal in that way. Like they begin to recognize patterns and they begin to recognize vocabulary, and the more vocabulary they have, the better they read, and the better they read, the deeper their vocabulary understanding becomes. And then the deeper their understanding, the more they can read, the more knowledge they build, the more they can read, the more language structures they're exposed to, the better they can read, the more language structures they get exposed to, and on and on, and like even right through motivation, right? So all of the strands, and also two things that are not on the left side of the strands, right, is motivation and fluency. And those are also reciprocal. Like the more we read, the better we get at those things, the more motivated we are to read because we're having success. The more we read, the more fluent we become.
I just love that visual of strands twisting together, making the student a more and more successful reader. And to round out the word recognition portion of Scarborough's Rope, Dr. Bruce McCandless, professor of neuroscience at the Graduate School of Education of Stanford University, stopped by to unpack sight recognition from the perspective of brain science. What happens in the brain as word recognition becomes increasingly automatic? How is today's increasingly technological learning environment shaping the brains of young readers? Let's hear from Bruce.
Well, you know, I think of cognitive science as really the study of like how the mind carries out its central functions, like, you know, recalling our memories or interpreting the feelings in somebody's expression, understanding the words we hear and kind of seeing all the objects in the world to guide our thoughts and actions. All of this cognitive science has been studied primarily by really looking in a scientific way at human behavior very, very carefully and very analytically. And we've been able to develop great theories about how function works, and these theories have sort of come to really help explain how the human mind works. But at the same time, advances in neuroimaging, so just brain scanning, have really allowed us to take all of these functions and study them in a whole new way by understanding how different networks in the brain contribute to specific functions. It opens up a whole bunch of new questions that really sort of work hand in glove with cognitive science. So we can kind of ask, how does this network, if you can measure it, you can ask, how does one network differ from one learner to another in ways that really matter? And how do networks change over the course of a really successful learning engagement or tutoring experience or something like this? And what is the typical path from novice to expert? And then where are places that kids really get stuck along the way, and how can we help them? by studying cognitive science together with the methods of neuroimaging, we develop this new kind of hybrid way of looking at things, which is much more powerful than just looking at behavior alone.
Every time I speak to Bruce, it seems cutting-edge research continues to reinforce the simple view of reading. And that's the second strand of Scarborough's Rope all wrapped up. We've put a lot together this season thanks to these thoughtful leaders in the science of reading. We hope you've enjoyed these episodes, and we can't wait to kick off a new learning adventure together. Stay tuned for season 4 of Science of Reading the podcast, dropping this July. Thanks for listening, and keep your feedback coming. Do you want to learn more? Be sure to stay connected by subscribing on your favorite podcast app and join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. Visit amplify.com to check out all our free literacy events and upcoming Science of Reading symposium. Until next time, keep the hope. Take the action and stay in touch.